ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
It's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. This is The Law Report on ABC Radio National. In 2 weeks' time, Australia's social media ban for children under 16 will come into force. How will it work? Will it protect kids from harm? And could they find ways around the ban? 10 sites, including Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat and YouTube, must comply with the new laws, while other popular platforms like messaging apps and online games are not covered. Last week, Meta, which owns Facebook, Instagram and Threads, sent out notifications to hundreds of thousands of account holders that it has identified as being under 16, warning that their accounts will soon be locked unless they can verify that they are not underage. Snapchat has since done the same. John Payne's the chair of Electronic Frontiers Australia, an independent organisation that promotes and protects digital rights. He was also on the advisory board for the federal government's age assurance technology trial, which is linked to the social media ban. John, what has Snapchat announced?
It made an announcement regarding their approach to implementing the requirements for e-safety. And essentially, they're going through a process now of starting to notify all Snapchat users who they believe to be under the age of 16. And the process they're going to adopt for age verification is they will either make an assessment based upon the behaviour and personal data of users to infer age, use those signals to infer age. And for those who they believe to be under 16, they're again contacting them and saying that there's going to be a variety of methods to authenticate their age.
Before we talk about methods of authenticating age, how can the platforms identify those users who are most likely under the age of 16? There's something called the waterfall or cascade effect. How does that work, starting with Facebook?
Facebook might be able to infer from the age of my account when I opened it and looking at my interests or my internet browsing activity that I am over the age of 18. So, for example, I open up a Facebook account in 2007, and you know, I have a range of interests on that account that might relate to, you know, The Economist, it might relate to political activities, it might relate to photography, but there's nothing there that indicates that I'm pursuing interests that are, you know, potentially or likely to be followed by minors. So Facebook can make an inference from those signals that I am most likely to be an adult.
And if the platform identifies the user as potentially under 16, what information can it ask the user to provide to verify their age?
Facebook or other regulated platforms, if they cannot infer the age of a person, for example, they may have made a purchase using a credit card, which would be a good indicator they're at the age of 18, is age inference or age estimation based on biometric assessment. So in that case, it may require a short video or photo to be taken and submitted to the platform, and the platform itself, or more likely, the third party that the platform is engaging to do the age assurance will run an algorithm over that image, a video image or photographic image, and give a pass-fail for being over the age of 16. This is problematic from a few areas. Number one, it's easily circumventable because you can use a third party to sit in for you to submit a video or a photograph. The greatest rate of error in terms of age estimation tends to appear between the ages of 15 and 17, which are the critical cutoff rates for this legislation. And biometric facial assessment is also prone to error in relation to females and people of colour. So the error rates go up.
So there's facial age estimation. There's this kind of waterfall idea of how old your accounts are and what your interests are. What are some of the other verification methods?
The next cascade after age estimation would be identity verification, which would involve the person producing a credential that is, you know, government issued, that has their date of birth on it and most likely a photograph for verification.
A driver's license, for instance.
Well, it could be a driver's license, but kids under 16 don't have that, do they? So it's quite limited. So it might be a passport. It might be a proof of age card if they have actually applied for one. Student cards wouldn't be acceptable. So it's quite limited in the range of what credentials could be sought.
Have these processes been mandated or spelled out by the government, or are these processes simply what the platforms are coming up with themselves?
These processes have been articulated by the eSafety Commission. But what we need to talk about, though, is not just the methods of identity assurance or age assurance, I should say, are the risks that get attached to the various methods and also the processes that apply to each, particularly where you have a failure in the process. So a person who essentially seeks to have their age authenticated with Snapchat is 17, can lawfully access the platform, but is denied access by the platform and its age assurance software. So there needs to be a process there to review those decisions.
And do we know what will happen if a person is mistakenly locked out? What processes will there be to review a decision to lock them out? And who will be in charge of those processes?
It's expected that all these platforms will have appeal mechanisms and solutions. But all large organisations, especially big tech organisations, typically won't do this themselves. They'll outsource this to a third party and, you know, will go to the lowest bidder. So who's the cheapest service provider? And then we have a whole new range of privacy and security risks that are coalescing around that. And, for example, in the UK recently, Discord is captured by the UK Online Safety Act.
And that UK Online Safety Act places a responsibility on online platforms to make sure the content they make available to a user is age appropriate, and does that by age verification and other requirements.
They have engaged a third-party processor to manage the appeals process or the grievance process for individuals who are locked out of the platform but otherwise should not be because they are of legal age. They've already been subject to a data breach within 3 or 4 weeks of the Act taking effect, and, you know, some 75,000 credentials, copies of passports and other government-issued identity documents, such as birth certificates, have been stolen. So there's a real risk with this as well, and in the sense that cyber criminals are now aware that there will be a range of organisations that use third parties who provide their service as cheaply as possible, may not have good or best practices in security and privacy, and they become targets to try and steal or exfiltrate both personal data and also credentials.
So when it comes to the outsourcing of these verification processes, I think our Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has said, look, the platforms or anybody else who have access to information for age verification, they have to use and then destroy that information immediately. And that's a way of safeguarding or reducing the privacy concerns that you're talking about here.
Yeah, I think Albo has misunderstood Australia's Privacy Act. The Act has an obligation for organisations to destroy personal data once it's no longer reasonably required for any lawful purpose. So unlike tougher privacy laws, such as the General Data Privacy Regulation in the EU, that forces organisations to destroy personal data immediately after the purpose of its collection has been conducted, in this case, say, biometric age testing, they're then required to destroy that immediately, unless a lawful exception applies. Australia has long had a problem with data retention being inappropriately managed under our privacy laws, and has been an outstanding contributor to organisations keeping personal data for extended period of times than they otherwise should. And examples of data breaches that have become significant because of that unnecessary retention of personal data, you know, comes to mind of Latitude, Optus, Medibank, and so forth. So I think Albo's wrong on that count, but I was on the Age Assurance Technology Advisory Board for the government's Age Assurance Technology trial. And even the participating vendors in the trial, some of the vendors were found to be creating processes to retain personal data for extremely long periods of time, even on the basis that one day in the future, some agency with some lawful purpose may make a request to access their data. And that showed to me that those organizations that were doing this in the trial have poorly understood their obligations under the Act.
So you see real impacts on privacy for both adults and children if they hand over private information.
Absolutely.
John, I'm also wondering VPNs. There's a lot of talk about young people just simply getting on a VPN and avoiding this whole kind of Australian jurisdiction ban. Do you think that's likely? And if that does happen, what do you see as some of the issues around that?
Certainly it's the experience in the US where in the sort of southern red states, there's been several laws passed recently to prevent access to online content, pornography and adult content, requiring those platforms to authenticate individuals accessing their content. I mean, each of the jurisdictions where this law has passed immediately after saw a 1,000-fold increase in inquiries for VPNs as a simple way to skirt the issue. There's also a risk associated with kids and their likely, very likely behavior in downloading VPNs from an app store. More than likely, they will choose a VPN that's free because they're kids. But the issue is there's another risk there, is that the providers of free VPNs aren't really free. They surveil you, they collect your personal data, and they trade it, they sell it to third parties. So most kids wouldn't be aware of this, as opposed to more reputable, trustworthy VPN where you're paying your monthly fee, wouldn't engage in that behaviour. It wouldn't bridge that trust.
John, the eSafety Commissioner says she's working with the platforms to make sure that VPNs won't be used to bypass the process. What do you make of that assertion?
I'm sure she's working with those platforms, but it doesn't necessarily guarantee success will arise from that those negotiations. Certainly, it's nothing covered in the current industry codes or the legislation, I think, that would give eSafety the power to demand those platforms put in place controls to prevent the use of VPNs or detect a VPN signal.
Now, acknowledging that you're not an expert in the mental health of young people, in your view, will the ban reduce the harms? And I understand you do recognise the harms associated with social media. Will this ban reduce those harms?
It's not a silver bullet. It certainly will have some impact by restricting or preventing kids under the age of 16 from accessing social media. But it depends upon what sort of harm are you talking about. Are you talking about the potential harm that might arise from bullying? Are you talking about the potential harm that might arise from doom scrolling? Are you talking about the type of harm that might come from misinformation or disinformation that is issued by a social media influencer? Or are you talking about the behavioral modification that is driven by algorithms and the dopamine drip cycle that the platforms exploit? Or will kids who can't access social media, assuming they don't circumvent it, and, you know, rest assured, a lot will they simply go to the next device? Will they, you know, put down the mobile phone and jump on the PlayStation? Or will they jump on the Xbox? Or will they jump on the computer and play computer games like Diablo or something? The government seems to have drafted this legislation, this policy, on the basis of 1970s nostalgia. Kids on December the 10th will not put down their phones and, you know, jump out on their bikes or go to the park or grab the footy and, you know, get out in the sporting fields again around Australia. It's not going to happen. This generation and this preceding generation are digital natives. They are firmly embedded into digital life and culture. So whilst you're restricting access to certain technology for a certain subtype of user, those users will go to other technologies in order to participate. So I think government really has underestimated or how kids will adopt to these changes, or adapt to these changes, I should say.
But I think that the government's view is, and the eSafety Commissioner's view is, that yes, that there will be adaptation and migration. And as that happens, that will be monitored and the authorities will respond with what is on the list of platforms under the legislation. So it is going to be a dynamic moving list as we move forward.
It's not just, you know, adding platforms to the list. What we're talking about is substituting behaviour with other forms of technology and engagement with technology. So if I can't be on Facebook, for example, I'm going to go and play PlayStation instead and, you know, while away the hours on that. If the concerns are to, you know, prevent kids from being on their devices endlessly, social media bans don't solve that problem.
What, in your view, should the government do instead? Where should it focus its regulatory efforts? And you talked before about rewarding the dopamine hits. What do you mean by that? And what do you think is the best way forward?
To fully solve this problem, there needs to be a recognition of the government that the potential harms that come from social media and big tech platforms that seek continual engagement don't just affect kids, they affect adults as well. And the only way that you're going to affect appropriate social change and to reduce the amount of potential harms these platforms can create is to break their business model. And to break the business model, you need to introduce a digital duty of care that requires platforms and big tech to put in place appropriate safety designs for not just kids, but also adults, that prevents algorithmic-driven behavioural modification, that prevents constant engagement, again, through the algorithm to try and keep you online for as long as possible for the sole purpose of selling advertising, to put in place stronger privacy laws when Australia has, you know, for some period of time, extremely weak, not fit-for-purpose privacy laws. Our privacy laws really are fit for the past millennia, not the current millennium.
So perhaps we should be thinking about these new laws, the under 16 ban, as the beginning or the first building block of a different kind of regulation and engagement, which might include what you're suggesting, a digital duty of care to stop the surveillance-based economy by big tech or rewarding the dopamine hits with shocking inflammatory content for everybody.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this initial attempt at regulating big tech and their social media market is very popular. It polled extremely well. The public like it. And it was, you know, pushed through very brutally in the final session of Parliament in 2024, allowing organisations only 2 days to comment upon the bill and make submissions. So in that respect, it was a pretty grotesque breach of the democratic process.
You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National. My guest today is John Payne. He's the chair of Electronic Frontiers Australia, which is an independent not-for-profit organisation that promotes digital rights. But I just want to confirm, John, you have no connection to the social media platforms or big tech?
Absolutely not. EFA is an organisation that lobbies and tries to educate the public on some of the harms that big tech brings to us, often, you know, without question. You know, for example, the debate happening at the moment around AI and privacy and the potential harms that unregulated AI could bring to the Australian people.
And we might be looking at that in following weeks. So how will regulators determine if the platforms have not done what is required under the legislation and therefore should be fined this, you know, $49, $50 million fine? What's the test, John?
The obligation is to take reasonable steps to comply with the requirements that have been issued by the Safety Commissioner. And wherever you have a legal requirement that states that a person or an organisation has to take reasonable steps, you do have a lot of grey area. So you can be sure that the platforms will do as little as possible, as reasonably possible, in order to achieve compliance with that obligation. And as to how successful they are or not, no doubt the Safety Commission will be conducting audits or requesting data from the participants to see how they're going once the changes take effect.
So it's very much a wait-and-see scenario over the next few weeks. Look, we spoke a little bit about other jurisdictions, I think in the southern states of the USA, restricting access to online porn and what's happened in terms of VPNs there. You've talked about what's been happening in the UK with Discord had been deploying age assurance technologies and those being hacked. We also have, coming in from December 25, independent of this legislation, separate age verification measures for Google and Bing from 2025. So there's also self-regulation taking place. Can we call it that?
Wouldn't you say it's self-regulation? It's the industry code that the eSafety Commissioner's Office has put together following a consultation process with industry, as has been the case with all of the other industry codes issued by eSafety. So in this instance, it's going to require internet search providers to put in place steps to prevent access to adult material or content. And there are a couple of carve-outs or methods by which those search service providers can achieve that. One is that they can infer from their users' accounts, you know, what is their likely or probable age based upon their browsing and search query practices over a period of time. Again, similar to some of the age assurance techniques that are used for social media. And they have other applications in regards to the blurring of images that might be returned in search queries. So it really is, again, a very strong censorship of the internet being brought forward by eSafety. And again, it can be circumventable quite easily, you know, through use of a VPN and whatnot, by browsing anonymously, not actually browsing through a registered account.
Coming back to the under-16s social media ban, do you imagine that there will be legal challenges either by young people or by the platforms themselves?
Certainly the big platforms in the US are getting very hairy-chested over this because they're very close to the White House and they're taking our law as a significant impact on their freedom of speech rights, which the Trump administration takes pretty seriously. Most recently, the eSafety Commissioner has been summoned to appear before Congress to give testimony in respect of our social media bans and the impacts it's having on these US companies. So it's definitely got the attention of the White House and it's definitely got the attention of politicians over there. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, whether it results in further litigation or attempted litigation. Certainly with regards to a more recent enforcement activity where the eSafety Commission applied a $1 million fine to Signal. Signal were initially intending to appeal that and take it to court. I understand in the news recently that they have not, that they're not going to proceed with that challenge.
So could there be a legal challenge by, say, a young person, maybe a sort of a political activist, a climate activist, arguing that their implied freedom of political communication has been breached, impinged, I think is the correct term, under this legislation? Is that a possible source of a challenge?
Well, it's certainly possible. I mean, a high court challenge is very, very expensive. But I understand former Liberal member is trying to put together a challenge to the High Court on this very issue. I just don't have the details before me at the moment.
And what would be the basis of that challenge?
We're looking at potential restrictions on the freedom of political speech, but given that the individuals under 16 don't have voting rights, it may not necessarily get legs to get up to the High Court, unless we're going to be relying upon international instruments like the UN Convention on the Child, which talks about freedom of speech and political speech. And Australia has signed up to that instrument, I believe. I think just watch this space. It's early days yet.
Yeah, well, certainly there are many very highly politicised and activist children in the climate space, along with many, many others. So it'd be very interesting to see if that flies. Could the companies commence some kind of legal challenge? Do we know?
It's certainly within their wherewithal to do so. I mean, they have extremely deep pockets and, you know, enormous, you know, reserves of cash and money. But I don't think they want to push the Australian government that much. There may be some potential argy-bargy coming from the more politically active organisations like X, particularly knowing the owner of X and his propensity for bombast and attention-seeking behaviour. Musk may well, you know, bring a suit against Australia. But I think his chances of success are very low.
John, what do you reckon is going to happen in 2 weeks' time and over the ensuing few months? How is this going to all pan out?
I think there might be a few parents that are going to be, you know, pleased by the ban starting, but less pleased with its effectiveness and the way kids will easily circumvent it by either using VPNs, using parties to assist them to pass biometric image testing, or even getting their parents' permission to use social media accounts or their own social media accounts, for example, like YouTube. All these things are going to happen, I think. eSafety certainly have undertaken a commitment to keep data over the next 12 to 24 months on the implementation of the ban and to determine its effectiveness and efficacy. It would be interesting to see if they actually captured metrics around the number of kids who were, again, circumventing the ban and the technological controls to enforce the ban.
How closely is the rest of the world watching what we're doing here in Australia?
Pretty closely. There appears to be in various jurisdictions a lot of talk about age gating of young people in respect to accessing adult or content. And that's a lot of that discussion is happening in America right now, particularly with the way bills get framed in conservative states using a template and then get sort of passed around to other conservative states to uptake. In the EU, we're seeing some jurisdictions that are displaying interest in social media bans and age authentication. The UK has been a first mover, but other jurisdictions are also considering this.
John Payne, Chair of Electronic Frontiers Australia, an independent organisation that promotes and protects digital rights. So thank you for speaking to the Law Report.
My pleasure, Damien. It's great to be here.
That's the Law Report for this week. Do follow the program on the ABC Listen app. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. A big thanks to producer Christina Cucoglia and also to audio producer Tim Simons. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more Law.